This is Mike Michalowicz, author of Get Different, Marketing That Can't Be Ignored, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I do this podcast to help me and my listeners keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow their revenue. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Mike Michalowicz to talk about his book, Get Different, Marketing That Can't Be Ignored, published by Portfolio Penguin. By his 35th birthday, Mike Michalowicz had founded and sold two multi-million dollar companies. Confident that he had the formula to success, he became a small business angel investor and proceeded to lose his entire fortune. Then he started all over again, driven to find better ways to grow healthy, strong companies. Since then, Mike has devoted his life to the research and delivery of innovative, impactful business growth strategies. Mike is the creator of Profit First, which is used by hundreds of thousands of companies around the world to drive profit. He's the creator of Clockwork, a powerful method to make any business run on automatic. He's the author of Profit First and Clockwork, Fix This Next, a Wall Street Journal bestseller, The Pumpkin Plan, Surge, and the toilet paper entrepreneur. Today, Mike leads two new multi-million dollar ventures as he tests his latest business research for his books. He's a popular keynote speaker, a former small business columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and business makeover specialist on NBC. Mike's also a guest lecturer at universities including Babson, Boston College, Columbia, Copenhagen Business School, Emerson, Harvard, Penn State, Pepperdine, and Princeton. His books have been translated into over 25 languages and are in the core curriculum for business students at many, many universities. And, interesting fact, he is a graduate of Virginia Tech, go Hokies, where he was captain of the Virginia Tech lacrosse team. Mike, congratulations on Get Different and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you. I thought you were going to say, and he's a blowhard.
No, there's only room for one of those, and that's me. And I made that real clear to you, Mike.
Any chances you're a Hokie, I always get excited to meet another.
Oh, no, no. I went to a school up the road called Virginia Military Institute.
Oh, my greatest learning lesson happened at VMI.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah,
on the field.
Oh, at playing them in lacrosse?
Yeah, yeah. You guys had an excellent team, and I remember, it is interesting, I learned about the power of the mind at a game against VMI. My capability was facing off. That's what I was particularly good at and really excelled at in high school and was able to apply to college. And it actually increased my stature on the lacrosse team because of that capability. So I almost expected to dominate faceoffs until I went to VMI. And one of the, is it Keydet?
Yeah.
Kicked my ass till Sunday. And it was the wake-up call I needed. For the first half of the game, this guy was just beating me over and over again. I'm like, this is not possible.
You said, yeah, I'm Mike Michalowicz. What's going on here?
Oh, don't you know, as I said that to him, Mike, don't you know who I am?
Yeah.
And then I said, oh my gosh, I have a choice here. At the halftime, the coach wasn't talking to me about it. They were doing other stuff. I sat down with myself and said, I have a choice here. I can decide to play better today, or I can decide to cave in to what I wanted to define as a new reality. And I said, no, I'm going to amplify. I just changed my mindset. And I was able to kind of win out the rest of the game. And that was a realization that our mindset determines, our body comes into alignment with our mindset. And mm-hmm. it was my greatest college lesson in retrospect was there at VMI.
Wow, that's interesting. So just to back up, so I you know, I'm a closet Hokie fan, I guess you could say. I mean, I'm here. I live in Virginia. And over the years, I've interviewed two authors who are graduates of the University of Texas. And last year, I was able to even things up by interviewing my second author, who's a Texas A&M graduate. Okay,
you know. Oh, there you go.
You know who those people are. Okay, so I've interviewed two authors who are University of Virginia graduates. Okay,
yep.
And great guys, great interviews. And now I'm so pleased to finally have a Virginia Tech grad on the show. And now I'm now in search of that second one to keep things equitable.
So, in balance.
I don't have to explain to you why that's important. So not only are you a Virginia Tech graduate, you actually make fun of the University of Virginia in your book.
In every single one of my books, I laud Virginia Tech. I humble UVA. And it is so sophomoric of me, but I just cannot resist the opportunity. So yeah, I take a total pot shot at the UVAers, which I have quite a few friends from UVA, and they're extraordinary people, but damn it, I'm a Hokie, you know, blue collar graduate, and I got to pick on the haughty UVAers.
That's right. You talked about them being haughty, and I couldn't resist. There's a joke I have, a meme. I'll post it on the show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, and it says an atheist, a vegan, and a UVA grad walk into a bar, and then it says I only know this because they told everyone within 2 minutes.
I love it. Poor UVAers.
I know, but you know what? It's like redneck jokes that Jeff Foxworthy would always tell. The people that loved it were the rednecks. So I think UVA people secretly enjoy that. And I don't think we have to worry now because they've all probably tuned out anyway. So your name, it is spelled M-I-C-H-A-L-O-W-I-C-Z. It's mispronounced all the time. Last week, I was interviewing an author. She mentioned one of your books. And then she said, but I don't know how to pronounce his last name. So we've pronounced it already, Mikhailovich. And in the book, you actually say, and I've got listeners in Ukraine, okay? You say that you met someone from Ukraine who said, no, that's not right. It's Mikhailovich.
That's right. That's right. Isn't that funny? So forever, I thought it was Mikhailovich. That's what my father told me. And I write in the book that our disadvantage, so a very difficult to pronounce last name, can be our advantage. I leverage it by making fun of it regularly and encouraging others to make fun of it, which actually is a way to learn it. But I was traveling, and this one guy from the Ukraine is like, oh, no, it's Mikhailovich or Mikhailovich. Right. I'm like, oh, my God. He's like, you're not pronouncing it correctly.
Yeah, and now you know how everyone else feels, Mike, about pronouncing your last name. So
yeah.
I should also add that you had a short-lived hip-hop career, and your stage name was Fat Daddy Fatback.
Very Googleable. I have proof.
Okay, a video of it?
Yeah, if you type in Fat Daddy Fatback, you will find remnants of my career.
Eminem, well, you are going to be the king of the show notes because I'm going to include that video if I can find it. Now, I noticed there were a couple other authors I've had the honor of interviewing, and they had this to say about your book. Alan Dibb, author of The One-Page Marketing Plan, excellent book, great guy. He writes The Ultimate Primer for Anyone Who Needs Great Results. And John Jantz, author of Duct Tape Marketing and The Ultimate Marketing Engine, and I'm actually interviewing him next week about
that. Oh, my gosh, he's awesome. Yeah.
In fact, I first heard about your book from John. He writes, a breakthrough book that reveals a fundamental truth about marketing. People remember, talk about, and share things that are different. Different is your job. Different will radically transform your business. And I just have to say, Mike, in the book, you write that your heart screams to make the reading experience fun, and this was one fun book to do that in. I hadn't interviewed you before, but it was a lot of fun to read the book. You're a very funny guy, and I know funny. I'm a clownfish. So I want to read just the introduction here. It's very short, and you write, yeah, no. Introduction, schmintroduction. Let's cut to the chase. You and I have a crucial job to do. As in the life or death of your business kind of crucial. You offer something people need, something a lot of people will love, or at least something a lot of people would love if only they knew about it. What good is your offer if no one knows it exists? The lack of marketing, good, effective, different marketing, is the driving reason for small business mediocrity and stunted growth. Too many great products and services languish in obscurity. We will not stand for that. By the end of this book, we are going to make sure you get noticed and get results in a crowded market no matter what. Are you ready? let's market the shit out of your business.
So can I put a little asterisk? You, Douglas, are the, you just read that in a one read, like a one and done. When I went to the studio for the audiobook, literally that two paragraph intro, I think took me four reads to get through. That's how inefficient I am as a reader. That was awesome.
Oh, wow. Well, you know, the pressure's on you, really, not me, to make this a good interview. So I'm kidding. I want you to relax and have a good time. Now, as I mentioned before we were interviewing, I was reading your book. It was very funny, very entertaining. It's the kind of thing where I had a sense that if you and I were to meet in person, our wives would say, no, we're going to need to keep those guys separated because it's, you know, this isn't good. Please.
Yeah.
But I was also in a Ron Burgundy glass case of emotion, because there are certain things in here where maybe I got even more out of it, because certain things you describe I've seen with companies, I've seen with clients, and I've never seen it explained this way. And I almost wanted to order a copy of this and send it to one particular client who is really suffering from this fear of being different. But there was another thing that got me really fired up, and we can talk about that. And that is, I see, as do you, a lot of companies just waste a staggering amount of money on what they think is marketing. And it's largely because they've had such bad advice, or they're just buying what somebody knows how to do, okay? Yes. Or you know, oh, you just need to run more Facebook ads. And that's all they know how to do. And your friend Yannick, on page 4, he wrote, or you quoted him, and he said, you had the same experience. And he said, if people are buying shit, it may be their problem, but it's your fault. Mm-hmm. If people are buying shit, it may be their problem, but it's your fault. And I kind of took that personally, and I got the impression that you did too. And I just want to start with this one story, and then I promise not to talk too much. But it's on page 69, and you were talking about when you were writing this book, you reached out to your community, and you asked a question, and you said, I'm looking for a story of a business owner who just can't make it happen with marketing and wants to give up, or is just caved and feels this is the way it needs to be. And I just thought, gosh, I see so many companies like that. And I just want to read this story, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, and I'll come back in about 45 minutes to see how you're doing. No, I'm kidding. You write, this is what she wrote. I've spent the last 9 months since I started my business trying to figure that out. I gave up and hired someone, and nothing happened. I've spent thousands trying to get marketing going. I have worked with dozens of so-called specialists, posting on my own, reading about what to post, so much more. I'm an accountant and a tax planner preparer. It's a business that no one wants to talk about. I save clients up to $30,000 a year in taxes. My first client, that's exactly what I did for them. I got a website, hired another web designer, and then hired another web designer until I found one who created a website I liked that covered everything I do properly and professional, and yet no sales. I found another, quote, coach who was teaching people how to do their marketing. I told him I didn't want to learn anymore and spend more money, so he agreed to do the marketing for me. He said, I have such a great knowledge that anyone who talked to me would want to hire me. He thought he could get me 30 to 50 contacts to talk to within 30 days. 5 months and $8,000 later, and I still have nothing. He finally got one person to call me, and it's someone who used to work with me in the past, and I had fired them. All I do is sit at my computer trying to come up with something to get customers. I am at my computer pretty much from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. and sometimes longer, learning new things that might help me get new clients. I really have about 8 hours of work a week with my few clients that I had when it was a part-time gig. I need to have 10 times the clients I have now just to keep paying the rent. It's very disheartening that nothing seems to work. And then, Mike, you go on to write that, you know, obviously she felt taken advantage of by what you call the big fat marketing lie. What is this big fat marketing lie?
Yeah, that was the story of Linda Weathers and the lie she fell victim to. And so many businesses do, is that if your marketing isn't working, you're not doing enough of it. You know, we're told, like, run Facebook ads because that's what everyone else is doing. And when the Facebook ads don't yield the results you want, the response is, well, clearly you haven't run enough Facebook ads yet. You got to double down and triple down. And that myth is perpetuated everywhere. If it's not working, simply do more of it. So it exhausts us. And her story just epitomized that. And I was honored, first of all, that she let me include it, because it's a humbling thing to share. but it is the reality for the majority of us. And was the essence of why I wrote this book is doing more of what's not working won't fix things. We have to do different.
Right. It's like, well, content marketing doesn't seem to be working, so do more content.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, volume only works at an extreme level. So there's a guy named Iron Cowboy, for example. This guy has run, he ran the Ironman, and hundreds of thousands of people have done the Ironman that you'll never know. This guy just ran 50 Ironmans 50 days in a row. So he gets the notoriety as the Iron Cowboy. That's remarkable and different, but only one person will achieve that. The person that runs now 48 Ironmans in a row is unremarkable. So doing more of something can work only in the most extreme circumstance. And it's such a rarity that it's a dangerous trap thinking that's the only way. What really works is be the first in the space to do something. Because the first is now the winner. So be the first to do what no one else is doing, and you'll get the notoriety and exposure. There's a lot more to it, but from the advocate standpoint, from our standpoint, when you're the first to do something, it's a blue ocean. There's great opportunity. If you're trying to do more of what's already working, it's going to be a bloody battle.
So, Blaine, let's go back though. Let's talk. Just dig into a little bit of this. You explain what you mean when you say that marketing happens in milliseconds, not months.
Yeah, I found this fascinating. And a lot of the research that I was doing was challenging the preconceived notions I had. What I thought was effective marketing was a good marketing plan. Like a great marketing plan wins and a bad marketing plan fails. And that is true, but a marketing plan doesn't necessarily consider the milliseconds of marketing. It's the long-term play. But first, we have to master that. What I delved into was the study of how the human mind works. And in this case, the application to our prospects. But this is true for all of humanity. We actually are wired to ignore most things. So right now, Douglas, around you in your space, there are thousands, tens of thousands of things that could draw your attention. Mm-hmm. And right, for example, in front of me, I have a paperclip here. It's actually two paperclips kind of clinked together as a white one and blue one. And I could spend literally hours investigating these paper clips. Like, oh, they're made of metal. There's like a little plastic coating. Who thought the word plastic, the colors, you know, what evokes colors? I could just go down this rabbit hole forever. But our minds are designed to ignore 99.9 to whatever exponential factor.
Yes, I've heard the human brain described as a really efficient ignoring machine.
Yes, that's what we do. Exactly. And that's what our mind does. It's designed to ignore. But there's three things that our mind has to evaluate every single time. And one is a threat. So if we were doing this interview face-to-face and I plop down like a gun and say, hey, Douglas, you mind if we go another hour with this? I guarantee I'll win your attention that moment. But the problem with using a threat is you'll punch me right in the nose, break my face wide open, and you know, you're going to defend yourself. So that's a bad move. The second way to garner attention guaranteed is to plop down opportunity. So if I plop down a stack of $1 million and say, hey, Douglas, we should have a discussion about doing this for an hour longer. I really want to garner more exposure for myself. I have your attention, but the risk is now completely on me. You may take the money and run. You may say, yeah, let me think about it as you walk away with the money. So it's massive risk in either case.
But if you do want to send me that,
as an experiment, we could try it out and just see what happens, right?
I'm just trying to help.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So the third way, which is always effective, it always works, is to do something that's unexpected. If we were outside and something squiggles in the grass, we will definitely jump back and then evaluate, is this a snake? Did someone turn the hose on? Mm-hmm. What's going on? Unexpected always goes to the prefrontal cortex where there's conscious thought because we have to evaluate, is this a threat or opportunity? Mm-hmm. Now, why I talk about the milliseconds is that literally happens faster than a blink. So if you try blinking right now, that will take you about 1/10 of a second. Our thought processing happens faster than that at a subconscious level before it is brought to a conscious consideration. In our marketing, we have to win that first blink. And if we get it, we are guaranteed to have the consumer's attention. If it's unexpected, they must evaluate it because they're considering it as a threat or an opportunity. Mm-hmm. I've won now you for 1/10 of a second. I have to matriculate that all the way to the transaction. So there's more steps to take, but that's where it all starts.
Right. And before we get into some of the details about the fairly scientific approach you have here, it's easy to explain, but you really do need to read the whole book and go through all the exercises that you you include. Let's go back to that past client I had. Can you talk about the primary reason why we struggle to get noticed? What is it that contributes to this sea of sameness out there?
Yeah, there's this awkwardly primal factor that influences us, and it goes back to the Neanderthal days. So as humanity, the only way to survive yesteryear in the tribe days was to be an active participant to the tribe, to support whatever the tribe as a whole wanted to do. So if the tribe's like, hey, we're going to go hunting for a woolly mammoth, I got to be on board with this. If I'm like, hey guys, I got a better idea. Let's go after a saber-toothed tiger. The tribe may say, screw you. You're out. You're on your own. How dare you contest what we're looking to do? And collectively, they're going hunting the woolly mammoth, and I'm out of the tribe. That is certain death for me. So being the exception was certainty for death. Mm-hmm. It was literally that equated. Fast forward to modern times, and while societally we've changed rapidly, that Neanderthal wiring still exists.
Yeah, we still have our cave-dwelling ancestors' brains.
Exactly. And it's bizarre because we all know at a logical level that standing out, being distinct and different is the way to be recognized. That's mm-hmm. a way to be accepted by a new tribe. But there's this dichotomy that the other part of us is saying, but don't do it because you'll be punished for it or mm-hmm. you'll be dead. So there's this bizarre phenomena that we want to be noticed without being noticeable. We yes. want to stand out without having to stand out.
Yeah, it's like companies are afraid to stand out. And there was actually another book on the show called Standout Marketing. It was all about the sea of sameness. In the first half of the book, they explained why it happens. And it's related absolutely to what you just described and why companies behave the way they do to – it's almost like they don't want to get noticed. And I want you to talk about – you know, I've seen so many companies that want to talk about how much better they are. And we you know, and I can think back to companies that say, our products are better, but the other yeah. guys are outselling us. Explain what you mean when you say better is not better. Different is better.
Yeah. So better is unnoticeable. So let's say we had competing businesses and I answer the phone for customer service in 2 rings and you answer the phone in 1 ring. You are unequivocally on a statistical level better. But the question is, do customers notice? And the answer is no. Mm-hmm. You know, we know intrinsically we're better in multiple ways compared to our competition. But our clients don't appreciate that. They really judge us on about 1% of what we do. So most of the better elements are ignored. Mm-hmm. Different, though, to our earlier point, is undeniable. When I'll give you another example. My first company was in computer technology. I set up computer systems. I was a computer guy. Mm-hmm. And I was statistically better than most of my competition. The amount of accolades we'd received, the certifications and so forth. I still struggled to grow the business. We were never really profitable as I was growing it. And then one day, this one business came in and it kicked my ass till Sunday. And the company was called Geek Squad. They were different. They dressed in these uniforms like geeks, you know, the flood pants, the taped glasses, the narrow black ties. They drove Volkswagen Bugs that looked like, you know, Keystone Cops. And that little differentiation was so played into people's wiring, you could not help but notice them. And that opened the gateway for them exposing the service they do. And now they sold out to Best Buy. They now have $1 billion valuation collectively. And my company did not do that, we'll say.
Right. Yeah. And a great big section in the book about later on about how they did it, why they did it, and how effective it was. I want to go to one thing on page 13 where you talk about the workshops you do. You're a keynote speaker. And it was interesting to me where you say, one thing you do is you'll say to the audience, all right, pair up and share your most effective mm-hmm. way to bring in leads. Okay, you give them a couple of minutes. Talk about what happens. What happens there?
Yeah, this has been for me really eye opening, and I've done it in both formal surveys now, but mostly informal. And what I ask people is what their primary source of leads is from. And you know, this is critical. If you have no lead flow, you have no business. If no one knows you exist whatsoever and no opportunity comes your way, the business is done. It's so obvious. And what I want to demonstrate in this is to show how myopic our marketing is, that we stay within such a narrow tunnel. So I ask people, what's your primary lead source? And braggadociously, and I was this way for the longest time, people say, well, number one, word of mouth, referrals.
You know. Yeah. And almost prideful.
Yeah, people pound your chest. You know.
And they'll say, we've grown this business and we haven't done any marketing, which is actually not true. But
and then they light a pipe and...
Yeah, right. I mean, what I say to them is, really, how much do you deal with the pricing? Oh, yeah, we deal with that every day. What about product development improvement? Yeah. Then I go on to explain to them that marketing is not just promotion. It's other things. So, yeah, again, you sent me into that Ron Burgundy glass case of emotion because I have been there listening to this. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I get it. I've been there too. And I slip back into it. There should be something boastful about that, though, is that if clients are referring you, clearly they have an appreciation for your services, they see value in you, and they want to spread the word. That's pretty remarkable. But now we're at the whim of customers marketing for us. Literally, if that customer goes out of business or leaves, there goes our marketing with them. So I consider that the icing on the cake, but it surely isn't the cake.
Yes, and it's less predictable, although this guy named John Jantz wrote a great book called The Referral Engine about acknowledging that, but saying, you know, you can start to systematize how to properly ask for referrals.
But I agree, which is marketing in itself.
Yes.
Now you're building a deliberate system to generate that, right, and you're leveraging a quantifiable resource. So yeah. I agree. Just no matter what, we need to be able to control the throttle. If I need more leads today, do I have a surety that I can turn up the heat and start getting them today? If not, I don't have control over my marketing.
Okay, so you then write down like three big, you write down on the chart there, that everybody can see, you write word of mouth, client referral, and website.
Yeah.
And you say, all right, anybody that said that, put your hand down. I think you said 95% of the hands go down at that point.
Yeah, exactly. But everyone's hand goes down. And a few people have something that, you know, they think is really innovative. Like, oh, we did the mailer that is a best practice in our industry or something.
Or your content marketing you mentioned, or a trade show. Yeah.
Yeah, content marketing. Exactly. You know, I got a blog that yields nothing, but I have a blog. And my point in that little exercise is how homogenous the marketing has become. And the reason marketing doesn't work is because it's all the same. Part of that, we were talking about the ignoring system that humanity has. It's called habituation. Habituation is where we very quickly acclimate to a certain form of stimulus, quantify it as irrelevant, and therefore never pay attention again. Sirens have to change over time because we get used to sirens and we don't react. Like, you could literally hear the old, you know, high pitch, low pitch whining of a siren and walk across an intersection and that police car plows through you because it's so common. Mm-hmm. That's why they had to change to these strange iterations and derivatives of the siren to just disrupt that pattern of habituation. Mm-hmm. Well, in marketing, I talk about in the book, we become habituated so quickly. The first time I got a "Hey friend" email, you know, starts off, goes, "Hey friend," I was intrigued. I was like, what friend is calling me friend? Like, they're so friendly of this friendly friend. And by the time I got through, I was like, oh, this is irrelevant marketing. Damn, I don't want this. The next "Hey friend" that came through, you know, the next day or whatever, I ignored it. And I've never looked at one again. And I'm sure thousands have come through. It's a quote unquote best practice. But admittedly, when it comes to marketing, the best practice is the first one to practice it. Everyone else is replicating and therefore it's going to be habituated and ignored. So you have to do something that no one else is doing. You have to do different.
Yes. Beware best practices. So I want to ask you about one way to go about starting to go down this different journey. Okay, we've established how frightening it is for a lot of companies, and for good reason. I completely understand it. But when I talk about all these self-styled marketing expert gurus, it really grinds my gears. And my heart aches a bit for companies that have been taken advantage of. And I then realized I might have been onto something. Talk about your nemesis and how finding what our nemesis is actually can help you define your ability to be different.
Yeah, I do a little rantiness, and I don't like that tendency that I have to do that. The reason I did it is there's proclaimed experts and pundits of ideas that really aren't effective. They may have been for them, but again, replicating someone else is going to trigger habituation, but also it's inauthentic. I found ultimately we are best served if we amplify who we are. If we amplify our true self, that is different in essence. And also it feels authentic because it is. Mm-hmm. So that's necessary. I also found that I've concluded that marketing is the ultimate act of kindness. If what we deliver, we truly believe is better for our customers, that we care more for our customers than the alternatives, well, we have a damn responsibility to market accordingly. I also found that if we don't, they're going to find alternatives, which could be our nemesis. I think there's power in identifying a nemesis. It could be an ideology. Like for me, with Profit First, I believe that gap accounting, the belief that profit is the last thing to consider, is a huge mistake. So I'm rallying against that. But in other cases, it could
be. I'll include that TED Talk on your show notes as well. It was terrific.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And when it comes to gurus and pundits, there's certain companies out there that I'm like, they're teaching something that is totally against my ideology. So I talk specifically about info marketers that you see them lighting cigars with $100 bills. And that mentality of, you know, if you don't have a private jet, you're nothing.
Yeah. And they're at the airport in front of someone else's jet, and they rented
and it's fake to boot.
Right? And they rented a Bentley for 3 hours in front of some house that's for sale that's not theirs. Yeah.
Yeah. And the essence of those messages is I'm great. You're scum. You can maybe be like me if you're fortunate enough. And I loathe that message. Mm-hmm. I also get it does resonate with a certain community. Certain communities are inspired by that kind of derogatory and angry comparative kind of positioning. But I loathe that. I think there's power in having that nemesis. So I've identified businesses that act that way. And I got to fix it. It's caused me to rally my marketing. I am pushing for the work I do harder than ever because I'm trying to defeat that, what I've defined as the evil. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it is evil, but in my context,
it is. But it causes great harm. Just I think so. The story with the accountant.
Yeah, right. And I think it would be a disservice for me to go out there and trash and say, well, that guru's an idiot and ass. I don't think that's a service. That actually maybe even brings more attention to those type of businesses. I think instead, you know, this is a good versus evil, the old Pepsi versus Coke kind of positioning. I just got to market more aggressively what I'm doing and squeeze them out. So that's the power of the nemesis.
And really, it's no different from snake oil salesmen 100 years ago. So let's get to the DAD framework. That's pretty much the backbone of the whole approach and very much a large part of the book. And this, to my disappointment, I thought it was going to be filled with dad jokes.
I think I got one or two cheesers in there.
Yeah. And for that, I thank you. If no one else thanks you, Mike Michalowicz, this guy does. Okay.
Thank you, my soulmate.
Yeah. But let's talk about the DAD framework.
So what I try to do in my work is to boil down a concept to its essence. It's the application of the Pareto principle. What's the few things that have the biggest impact? And when it came to marketing, I identified there's three elements that consistently make marketing superior. And if any of these three elements are missed, it becomes lopsided or ineffective marketing. DADS is an acronym. It stands for first differentiate, what we already investigated. And the reason we must differentiate is that to the prospect's mind, it causes a pattern interrupt.
Yes.
It has to be evaluated. You win attention every single time. It's guaranteed, albeit short-lived. It's 1/10 of a second. We then have to rapidly move within a tenth of a second to the next stage, which is A, stands for attract. The message we're putting out there needs to speak to the prospect. They have to say, this is for me. This is where we position it as an opportunity. So does that advertisement, that marketing message serve a need I have? Does it satisfy a problem I have? Or more often, does it just simply keep me engaged? Is it entertaining? Does it invoke curiosity? Is there a reason to stay? And there's a reason why I think this is an opportunity for myself. The second there is a repulsion, meaning this doesn't serve me, it goes into the file of forever more ignorable. Mm-hmm. So one example of this is I could, you know, as an author, I could say, hey, you know what? I'm going to start doing like, I'm going to start dressing like a clown, like Bozo the Clown with big floppy shoes for my speaking engagements. Come on stage with that yucca yucca horn and go, hey, crowd, you know, I'm here to talk about my book. I guarantee
I already do that will get
attention.
So, yeah.
That passes the different test.
Right. Because, right. And you talk about an attorney, a trial attorney who could do that in the courtroom. Right? And that would attract attention.
Guaranteed.
You'd lose every trial.
But lose every trial because it's not attractive. Right. Because then the customer's like, oh, who is this clown? And right. You know, a clown for some people equals like murder and harm and scary because of the movies. It's an it, you know? So you have to be compelling. And some people, as they started reading the pre-release, were coming to me saying, does different mean outrageous? I'm like, not at all. Not at all. In fact, that's often repelling. Different simply means an amplification of who you are that is incongruent with your contemporaries, something that no one else is doing. That's what different is. So if everyone's being silly and you're professional, be more professional. If everyone's professional and you're silly, lay into that goof factor. And that will be attractive to the right community if it's authentically you and speaks to needs, interests, and curiosity. The last part of DAD is direct, and that is to give the prospect a specific action to take. And here's the key. It needs to be reasonable. It can't be a big, bold ask, which will turn them off. It becomes a threat now. It needs to be something where they say, oh, if I take this action, I am winning and the exchange is worth it. There's always a currency. I'm going to give you my email for that, you know, PDF or whatever it is. So there has to be a reasonable exchange that matriculates that relationship to the ultimate transaction, which is the sale.
Yes. And actually, if you do this correctly and it does not appeal to some people, that's okay. You know, it's like in the notion of in sales, a lot of the really good salespeople will say no is my second favorite word because they know what an ideal customer looks like. And again, I think everybody wants to be appealing to everyone, but if you really understand your customer and think this through, this works beautifully. Well, let me just add to this though, just because this is really watertight. I mean, you could have had 97 things. That would be a long word, a long acronym, but you only had three, which is, it's just amazing. You write, I'm no stranger to marketing fails, but I don't regret a single one because I learned from all of them. Every time I failed, after kicking myself, I would ask, what in the process was wrong? Where did it go off the rails? In hindsight, it is always obvious that it was inevitably a failure in one or a mix of these three simple steps of DAD. Quick question, though. You write that the best solutions always work with humans as they are,
yeah,
rather than trying to force them to change. Explain what you mean there.
Yeah, I find that we get far better results by channeling behavior as opposed to trying to change behavior. Mm-hmm. And you may notice if you read my other books that this is a tendency I have. Like in Profit First, I found, to get someone to read a profit and loss statement and balance sheet is very difficult. What we naturally do is go to our bank account. Therefore, that's where the system must reside. We need to channel that. What I found with marketing is we're trying to do what others tell us, even though it doesn't feel right. We don't understand it. We're not thirsty to do it. And then we settle back into our own tendencies. Interestingly, if we really look and examine who we are and what gives us the most joy, that's usually where we'll have the most comfort in marketing. So we need to investigate. What do I naturally like to do? How do I naturally like to express myself? Well, often you do this with your friends. Like next time you go out with a group of friends and you're chit-chatting it up, really consciously observe your own behavior, kind of trying to remove yourself from yourself in the moments and see how you behave. Are you the class clown? Are you the one who always brings balance and diplomacy to the group? What is it? those are your natural forms of expression. And then you can use that in your marketing messaging, and you'll be far, far more successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm always envisioning somebody who's still listening. You know, maybe it's a business owner or something, and they're sitting there with their arms crossed, or at least mentally their arms are crossed, thinking, I don't know, this marketing is stupid. I don't know.
Yeah.
And you write that the most common feedback you hear about this whole approach, and I'm going to quote, because actually it's one of your fraternity friends. You write, and I quote, "Your book is great, but it doesn't apply to me. We are in an established industry. Your different strategy will require too much change and too much time. Good stuff, Mike, but all theory." Your response?
That's Greg. Yeah. His fraternity nickname is Elk Turd.
Yes, and his real name is Eckler.
Yeah, his last name is Eckler, but he goes by Elk Turd. And the fraternity bylaws prohibit me from sharing that. So I will not share that he's Elk Turd. Elk Turd.
Well, and he also, you included what his fraternity name was for you.
Oh, McAllishits. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Which is also prohibited. But actually, I adhere to that one. I don't.
Fraternal affection going on there.
Yeah. I don't share my own. coincidentally, he's flying in day after tomorrow, and we're going to, the football season's about to start. We're going to watch a Virginia Tech football game.
Excellent. We'll give him a noogie. So what is your response when people say, because I hear this too with others, you know, like Marcus Sheridan, he'll say, you know, this is all great, Marcus, you know, they ask, you answer, but you see, we're different.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting that.
And actually, let me just interrupt. If you're in a boring industry, that's actually better, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's what Robert Stevens says. He's from Geek Squad. The more boring your industry, the easier the opportunity to stand out.
Yes.
Because no one is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this compulsion to think we're all different is part of the human genome. That's how we're wired. If you look at people ourselves, we say, wow, we're all so different. And we judge simply at the skin level. Well, your skin color is different. Your weight's different. Your sex is different. Your height's different. But when you peel back the skin of humanity, we're 99.9% the same. Like, a doctor's never come to me and said, "Hey, Mike, for your heart, do you keep yours in your foot? Like, where is it?" Before he starts this procedure, it's known we are identical internally. You know, the skin of business is different. A pizza shop looks different than an accounting firm. But when you look at the essence of it, it's 99% the same.
Mm-hmm.
We all have sales, marketing, must lead to conversion. We have to service and deliver. We have to manage customer expectations. It's all there. So when people say, "I'm different," I say, "Okay, yeah, your skin's different, but let's talk about, do you do sales?" And I'm walking through these elements. Like, yeah, I do all that stuff. With Greg, once he was willing to acknowledge that maybe this could even apply to his radically different real estate business, he was willing to experiment. And that was the other key component I found with humanity. When we do plans, it's a commitment. I plan to travel somewhere. And when we vary from it, we get very distraught. If there's an impedance, we may even turn around. But experiments, inherent to experiments, is failure. You know, experiments like, well, I'm going to try. We'll see what the results are. And inherent to experiments is learning. So I told Greg, we're not going to do a marketing plan. We're just going to do an experiment in how we market your real estate business. And then it becomes more palatable, because that's now working with the channel of who we are, as opposed to trying to change who we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the remaining time, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions. And I'd like people to think that you can just buy the book and, you know, like voting for Pedro, all your dreams will come true. But talk about the Target 100. You talk about, I mean, this is like so many smart business books. You really have to understand who your customer is. And you urge folks to talk about this Target 100. You actually need to go talk to people, and not your mom, not your friends. Go talk to strangers.
Yes. The worst people to survey about your business are people that know you, because there's a social currency that's occurring. I have to say, oh, I love your idea, Mike. It is so smart, because I'm the friend. And if I don't say that, it'll cause conflict. So we get this jaded perception that our idea, our marketing, whatever, is going to crush it because my friends say so. But the people who tell us the unabated truth are the strangers. They don't care. What they're focusing on is this going to serve me or not? And they speak through their wallets very loudly.
Yes.
So they pay attention to them.
As Jay Baer would say, hug your haters. Because that's hug, really...
Yeah. That's, yeah. They are the true truth sayers, the customers.
Yeah, absolutely. So one other thing that's so important. I mean, so in other words, you need to really drill down. This isn't the shortest book that you're going to read on a one-hour flight. There's actually quite a bit that you need to walk people through. And I believe you have workshops, and we're going to include links to all your websites and everything where people can find out more about this. But also quite a bit about doing effective experiments. You have to experiment quite a bit. And it occurred to me that one of the smartest questions like a CEO or a business person could ask of their whoever's helping them with their some of their marketing when they're presented a plan is to say, what experiments do you have planned? I think that would really floor a lot of marketing people. Like, I want you to be experimenting, just like Jeff Bezos does lots of experiments.
Yeah.
So talk about the importance of doing experiments, doing them correctly, and what that has to do with 90% of Def Leppard's songs really sucking.
Yeah, so I'll start there. So I am an awkwardly big fan of Def Leppard.
And hair bands in general, right?
And hair bands, yeah, I love it. You know, Sammy Hagar, oh my God, I'll wet my pants if I hear one song.
Well, you would get arrested for that, I think you said.
Oh, yeah. I referenced that in the book. Yes. I can't drive 55. But with Def Leppard and any of these bands, the majority of the stuff they produce is not a hit. And some of it really, really sucks. But they have a few hits, and that carries them forward. That's true for marketing, too, is we need to put the songs out there to see if it resonates with people. And the majority won't. But I think we're so hesitant to even try that we start this affirmation loop saying, well, my marketing doesn't work. And it doesn't work because I'm not doing it. And there's this kind of perverted inability to try marketing. I'll give you an example of a security company that we were able to, and I don't think they're included in the book. It was a fascinating story. They wanted to market, and they were working on marketing plans, which meant they were planning to do nothing, and they did nothing. We came up with an experiment, and they did it, and it just opened this person's vision to what they could do. They were they do high-end security, so they're actually weaponized with guns and so forth, and they go into insecure areas where corporations could be at threat. And there's this one company they were targeting in an area where they're located. And they know where the CEO's office is. It's the corner suite. It's pretty obvious. So what they did is instead of sending what their contemporaries were doing, was sending postcards, this company got a big sign. They put it in a public space on a sidewalk outside the building that could be seen from the CEO's office and said, we are ready to serve you at any time. We want to earn your business. They then sent by carrier a package to the CEO saying, really cool thing, please open. And inside was a pair of binoculars and said, look out your window. And so you're the CEO and she receives this. What are you going to do? This is so, first of all, it's different, right? You get a package delivered to you and you open it, there's binoculars, it's different. So it's garnered attention. It's attractive because it invoked curiosity. Look outside your window where you're going to not do it. You have to. So she looks outside the window and then she sees the CEO of the security business sitting there with his cell phone, and at the bottom of the number of the sign, it said, "I'm outside right now. Please call my cell." You got to. You just cannot do it. And she did, and that started a discussion. Talk about a foot in the door, and that opened up this company's eyes to say, "Oh my gosh, my target prospects are really one good marketing step away."
Yes.
And that they've done it ever since. So we have to win over our own trust in ourselves.
Well, and also when you talk about doing experiments, it seems to relieve a lot of pressure, like the fear of failure. No, boss, we're not staking our future. We just want to test this.
Yeah,
and
there's muscle in that. There's when we fail, the world doesn't collapse. They didn't
look at you.
Right? Yeah,
you're
I'm
doing
the definition
great.
Of failure.
Yeah.
and the world doesn't collapse. You just find a way not to do it. I am not ever saying do something illegal or unethical by any stretch of imagination. But when you work within the confines of morality and law, there's so many opportunities. And the consequences of failure are simply learning.
Yeah, it's interesting. Back to VMI. When you go there, you have to take boxing at one point, your first year. And I hated it. I mean, I got my butt kicked. I actually got a concussion. I was hospitalized, but I won that fight, just so everybody knows.
Oh, there you go.
So at the end of the season, at the end of that semester, after the very last fight, I remember the coach said, I think all of you got out of this course what you were supposed to get. And I was, of course, thinking, what the hell was the point of this
yeah,
course?
Yeah.
And they said, the purpose of this course was to teach you how to take a hit. And who's learned that more than a guy like you, who's, you know, you're just, it's almost like you're inoculated from fear now. Let me just ask in the remaining time one last question about the book. I once had an IT client. We were talking to the president, and he was talking about how when they were talking to a new prospect, they would ask about references, and he would always say, you know, I could give you a list of happy customers, but why don't I give you a list of customers where there was a problem?
Yeah.
And they're going to tell you how we work through it. Can you talk about this painting contractor?
Yeah,
and,
that's Matt Shout.
The disadvantage advantage. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. So Matt Shout's company, which paints houses, spray painted a baby black, like jet matte black. And the circumstance that came around was...
It was an accident.
It was an accident.
The painter was clogged and the people were behind him or something.
Yeah, exactly. And the paint exploded and the guy doing the paint calls Matt and he says, you got to come here immediately. And Matt asked his team to deep six this story because it's such an embarrassment. Like, what company does this? Until he realized that disadvantage may be his biggest advantage. Customers are so habituated to us lauding ourselves and patting ourselves on the back that it actually has become relatively ineffective. Of course, you're a 5-star rating on your own website.
Right.
So what Matt did is he flipped it. He said, we want to tell you about the horrors that came about because if we can navigate this, we can navigate anything.
Yes.
And his contemporaries are like, are you crazy to put that story out there? Like you painted a human, you put their health at risk. And he started putting it out there. Close rates jumped, exposure jumped because he was willing to show the ugly. There's a thing called the pratfall effect. And what it is when we show our true humanity, it actually invokes greater trust. When a celebrity has a blooper reel, we like that celebrity more.
That's yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. So, Mike, if readers took only one thing away from this book, what would you hope it would be?
My hope is that people realize marketing is the ultimate and deliberate act of kindness. You know, if we offer something that's better than our contemporaries, if we can be of better service to our clients, that is an act of kindness because now we're allowing our clients to discover what is of value to them. And I'm not suggesting you manipulate clients. If they still choose not to buy, that is their choice. But if they don't discover you, it is your fault. So be kind, market.
Yes. Give the listener one thing they could do today to put in action one of the ideas from the book or one that we've talked about.
Yeah, so random acts of kindness. I found to build muscle is to start just going out there and doing kind things for people. It's not a marketing scheme, but what it does is it starts building that muscle that, oh, you can put yourself out there. Mm-hmm. You'll find the gratitude. When you know, leave a kind note for someone on their car before you drive away and just say, hey, you parked really nicely and let me park easily too. Thanks for doing that. Wishing you a great day. You will never know how that affects them, but I know it'll affect you permanently. And once you start seeing that kindness, putting kindness out there makes you stronger, you'll start doing it through your marketing.
Amen. Amen. So what books have most inspired your working career?
You know, I'm reading The Happiness Hypothesis right now, and it's been so inspiring because it's challenging notions. The one thing I'm really ruminating on right now is there's a belief that at a certain point, money can't bring happiness. They say, you know, $75,000, you can't get more happiness. And this book says that's actually not true. More money does bring more happiness. We're just not shopping right. We're spending it on the effects of success. I got to have the nicer car, the bigger house. They said money can buy time, connection. It can be of service. So more money actually does bring more joy when spent appropriately. And that's, I love those concepts where we take an established belief that people are becoming entrenched in and say, hold on, is that really a belief or is that mythology?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I see that came out about 15 years ago, written by Jonathan Haidt. Interesting. I did not know about that. I appreciate you mentioning it. Are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading besides John Jantz's, The Marketing Engine?
Oh, I'm reading John Jantz's work. He's amazing. I'm going to read Dory Clark's Long Game. She's amazing.
Yeah, her interview will be right after the week, right after yours.
Oh, yeah. Well, all three of us are, you know, we're probably all like pounding you. Hey, can we get on your show? Because we're all launching the same day.
Yeah. That's how I have found out because John Jantz said, yeah, Mike's is coming out the same day. So it's like, all right, let's get everybody in there. So,
yeah. Well, and thank you for this. Is a big deal for me. And I'm sure John and Dory. I'm about to read The Wim Hof Method. I just bought the book and read the prologue. What's fascinating about it is this is about physical and mental strength. But what I find interesting is it, again, is challenging notions. stuff that's deemed to be a scientific conclusion where maybe there's scientific bias and he challenges things. I consistently find that fascinating. Once we believe something to be true, we have to question ourselves, is it just because we've heard it so many times or is it really true?
Interesting. Interesting. Another one I did not know about. So I appreciate that. And of course, the listeners love hearing about other books. Well, listen, at marketingbookpodcast.com, like I mentioned, we're going to include links to everything linkable, all your websites, the book resources, and your LinkedIn profile and so forth. Listener, please do me a big favor. Swarm Mike Michalowicz with thanks for being on this podcast. Just let him know you heard the podcast. You can tag him on LinkedIn or message him or any of those things. Cool. Please, please reach out. And if you're listening on your smartphone, you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite app. All these links can be found right now by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The book is Get Different, Marketing That Can't Be Ignored. The author is Mike Michalowicz. Mike, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Douglas, as always, thank you.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And remember the words of the entrepreneur and author Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Percent of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.